You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit bpn.fm to discover more.
Welcome to The Fabulous Invalid, a Broadway-centric podcast where we take an in-depth look at the theater through interviews with actors, directors, writers, choreographers, and everyone in between. I'm Jamie Dumont, recovering Broadway marketer, chef, and event planner.
And I'm Rob Russo, theater critic and writer with Stage Left at NYC.
Happy New Year!
Yes, it's 2020.
I can't believe it.
We made it.
Another year.
Another year's gone by.
Wow.
I'm still here.
Oh. You know? You're starting the year off with a song.
You gotta sing. You gotta sing.
But it's a sad song.
Aw.
I'm still here is a sad song.
Oh, yes. Well, yes. But an anthem. Ugh, what a good one.
But an anthem.
Yeah, right?
Well.
Here we are.
Here we are. So what are we doing today, Rob?
Well, you had the wonderful idea since 2020 marks the beginning of a new decade.
That it does.
Which is crazy to think about. We're in the roaring 20s.
I hadn't even made that connection.
Right?
Wow.
Kind of wild.
Rob. Yeah.
My brain's exploding a little.
Wow.
Yeah. We're getting old. What's the line from Angels in America? The earth has gotten so terribly, terribly old.
I have a few years on you.
Yeah. anyway, you had the idea that we could take a minute, pause, to look back on the previous decade of theater going, and for us to come up with our own personal lists of our top 10 plays and musicals that we saw.
Of the decade.
Of the decade. And what's interesting about this exercise is that it's sort of our favorites, right? So we should put that out there right away.
Mm-hmm.
These are our favorite theater going experiences. And it's based on what we saw, right? So we didn't see everything.
No.
No person could see anything.
Half the decade, you weren't even in New York.
That's right. I spent 3 years living in D.C. and then another 2 years working on a presidential campaign where I was chained to a desk for, 18 hours a day. So a good half of the decade, I really only saw like the musical or the play to see each year in New York. But I was seeing theater in D.C., so you'll see when we go through my list, I've got a couple D.C. shout-outs.
Which I love.
Yeah.
D.C. has a vibrant theater scene.
Well, there's theater everywhere.
Yeah.
Right? No matter where you are, you can, some exceptions. You can,
we won't name them.
Theater. Can't speak to the quality of it, but there's theater everywhere.
That there is.
Yeah.
Well, let's start.
Great.
Let's get this mother going.
Yeah. So as I said, Jamie set up the contours that we'd each come up with 10 plays and 10 musicals because that was sort of the only way we could wrest some sort of control out of the idea of having to tackle a decade worth of theater going. I mean, I probably saw, no joke, like 800 performances over the last decade easily.
I can't.
You probably saw.
I can't put a number
just
to my,
as many,
to my
right?
contour.
Yeah. So picking, 10, or I guess I should say 20,
right,
out of those is a really crazy task.
And this isn't the first time or the last time that we will say this, but I love a list.
You love a list.
I love to give Rob a list because
I love a list.
It sends you into a bit of a tizzy.
Oh, yeah.
Which I enjoy on several levels.
Yeah, you like to torture.
I love to
you
torture you. I know, it's sick. But, but also, I know that you love it. Like, I know that you love to sit down and think about what you've seen and relive some of those experiences.
Totally.
So we're going to do that right now.
Great. Let's do it. Okay. Let's just dive right in.
Am I going to start?
You're going to start.
Great. We're going to start with number 10 and work our way up to 1, if you didn't say that already.
I didn't.
I did. And my number 10 play is Other Desert Cities.
Mm.
However, the London production.
Oh, twist.
I'm specifically calling out the London production that was at the Old Vic with Sinead Cusack and Martha Plimpton. And I've said this on this show before. Martha Plimpton gave one of the most spectacular performances in that production I have ever seen.
Mm.
Love her. Martha, if you're listening, we want you on the show. but Other Desert Cities, John Robin Bates. Love him. Love that play.
So my 10 is Booty Candy, which is a play by Robert O'Hara, who is also a director. He directed Slave Play this past season in New York and has written, a bunch of other really great plays. But Booty Candy was really fabulous. I saw it at Woolly Mammoth Theater Company in D.C., which is a really great company that does a lot of really bold emerging works. It came to New York, and it was at Playwrights Horizons, But just like you called out the London production of Other Cities, I'm going to call it the DC production of Booty Candy, because the first time I saw it, it was unlike anything I'd ever seen before. It was very sort of like vignette-like, and a meditation on blackness and queerness, which we saw reflected this past season, you know, in the musical Strange Loop. Similar thematically, and at the same time, just like absolutely hilarious. It was a really, really great show that has stuck with me.
Wow. I hadn't even heard of it until you sent me this
list. Wow.
I had to look it up. I knew nothing about it.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just miss things.
Yeah.
I'm sorry I missed that.
Booty Candy.
Number 10. Now we're going to go to musicals,
yes.
Right? We're going to bounce around a little bit. So my number 10 musical is Follies at the National Theater. Stunning production. We've talked about it before. We've had Tracy Bennett on, who was in it.
Yeah. If you listen to our top 10 of 2019, I included it in that list. And it's going to show up, spoiler alert, on my list for the decade, but not yet.
Not yet.
Not yet.
So what's your number 10 musical?
My 10 is Soft Power. David Henry Hwang and Janine Tesori's musical, which I'd seen in Los Angeles in 2018 and then off-Broadway at the Public Theater this past fall. Which is just such an ingenious, smart musical tackling, you know, contemporary themes and really just about our democracy.
Democracy Will Break Your Heart.
Yes, and that show certainly did.
And I, you know, that was a struggle. It was on my list. It was off my list.
It's hard.
It didn't.
Coming up
it didn't
with 10
make. It didn't make my 10 of the decade.
Yeah.
But it's 11 probably.
There you go. Yeah. I feel like a lot of things are 11, you know?
Yeah, we might get to all of our 11s. We might not.
Alrighty. Number nine.
Number nine, my play is Peter and the Starcatcher. Particularly, I know several people that were involved in the creation of that show, and I saw it in La Jolla. I saw it at New York Theater Workshop. I think I even saw it in Williamstown. I think they did it. I saw that thing grow. And I think it was wonderful on Broadway. It was never more special than it was at New York Theater Workshop. It was really beautiful in that space. It just fits so perfectly.
Yeah.
So as much as I loved it on Broadway, I just want to do a little shout out to the New York Theater Workshop.
Well, New York Theater Workshop is one of the most special theaters in New York City. There's nothing beats the experience of seeing a show there. So I totally get that. And I loved it. I saw it on Broadway and I loved it. It was one that I caught. Okay, so my number nine play of the decade is The Inheritance, which, you know, again, that was on my top 10 of 2019, Matthew Lopez's modern adaptation of Ian Forster's Howard's End, set among a group of gay men in the present. I loved this play. I know it wasn't everyone's cup of tea. There's a lot of criticism around it, but for me, it was just such a beautiful piece. I loved the production of it. I think that part sort of got overlooked. And also just the reflection on the intergenerational relationship among gay men is something that I don't think we talk about enough. Mm-hmm. And I had never seen dramatized in the way that it was here. And, you know, I always say a fact of being gay is that you're 99% of the time a minority in your own family. And, you know, gay people, the LGBTQ community, makes their own family. And that's that idea, as expressed in the show, I thought was quite poignant.
I agree with you, and yeah. it's my number six.
Okay,
so it appears higher
again
on my list.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and this play in particular, not to belabor it, but you know, it's not shocking to me that it would be on our list because, you know, not to call you out, but you lived through the AIDS crisis.
I did,
right? And I am a member of the younger generation who is reflecting back on it, right? So we sitting across from each other sort of represent the bounds of the characters and age-wise in the play.
We do.
Right? So it's not surprising to me that we would both have that experience.
Well, since you brought it up, I did sit in hospitals
and
hold the hands of friends of mine and watch them die and go to a lot of funerals.
Right.
And I bore witness to an entire generation just being wiped out, which is also one of the most dramatic moments in the play when the John Benjamin Hickey character screams, an entire generation is gone. I'm paraphrasing, that's not the exact words. But I say that because I feel like it gets forgotten a little bit.
Yes.
And it gets swept under the rug that happened. And I think it's important to remember, and I think that it's powerfully and beautifully represented in this play, and I think that's important.
Yeah, absolutely. Alrighty, musicals, number 9.
Oh, are we on me? Oh,
yeah.
I got caught up in the moment. I did. Well, you know,
it's... For good cause.
Look, it's not... I consider myself a happy person. I consider myself a fairly well-adjusted person, neurotic as I am. But I don't really look back at the 80s very often in that context. Right. I look back at the 80s in my life as a very... I too gloss over it, right?
Because it's painful.
It's painful.
Yeah.
And so I just, for a moment, I was just living and I was just thinking of some people very dear to me that are gone. Mm. And it's affecting.
Yeah.
You have to remind me again where we were.
Yeah, well, we're on number 9, your musical.
Okay.
Total 180.
Yes, but not really. It's actually a story about a gay person coming out.
Yeah.
And that is Everybody's Talking About Jamie, the musical from London.
Now, is it just because the character's named Jamie? I have to ask.
Well, it's a great... Yes. it's a great name.
It's a great title.
I think it's a great musical, and I this is probably a controversial take, but again, that's what this is. These are my favorites.
Yeah.
I'm not saying these are the best. These are the ones that I loved. That musical hit me hard, and I don't think it's a perfect musical. I think it's
what's a perfect musical?
Right. It everything could use a little tweaking here and there.
Yeah.
But there was something about that show that just spoke to me, and I loved it, and I listened to that score all the time. I love it.
In me, something as perfect as it's pure. It means waiting until you know you're sure. It means beautiful, and it's beautiful.
Well, if you don't know the show, it's about a teenage drag queen who...
it's a true story.
It's a true story, yeah. It's based on a documentary
that was
produced about a teenage drag queen who wants to go and drag to the prom, right? And it's funny, you know, part of the reason why it probably hasn't come to the U.S. is between Kinky Boots and the prom, you know, it's sort of like, it feels like territory that has been covered, and yet this is a very unique and special thing unto itself and deserves its own... day in court, so to speak.
It's really a show about empowerment.
Yeah.
And it's really,
really
the story of somebody who says, fuck it, this is who I am.
Yep.
And I think I love those stories.
Yep, yep. Well, my number 9 musical of the decade is probably one that no one knows.
Don't say that.
And that's First Daughter Suite.
Oh yeah, no one knows
Nobody
that.
Knows that. Nobody knows that. So I'm obsessed with composer and writer, lyricist, Michael John Lacutia.
You really are.
I really am. And the first piece he ever did, the first full-length piece he ever produced, was the First Lady's Suite, which was at Lincoln Center in like 1993, a year before.
I always thought it was at the Public.
I'm pretty sure it was at Lincoln Center.
I had this clear memory of seeing it at the Public
Maybe
Theater.
It was at the Public.
I'm sure you're right.
Anyway,
I'm not saying you're
it
not.
It happened in 1993. And that was a series of 4 musical vignettes bringing to life the story of 4 different First Ladies. So in 2015 at the Public, he wrote a companion piece to it, First Daughter Suite, which takes the same structure, 4 different vignettes, but this time focusing on the stories of first daughters and their relationships with their first mothers, first ladies, mothers. I loved this piece. There's a cast recording. Thankfully, they recorded it. An exquisite cast, including, you know, Mary Testa. And
we love Mary Testa.
Barbara Walsh.
We love Barbara Walsh.
The Betsy Morgan and Rachel Bay Jones. I mean, I could go on.
Yeah, like, it is a great
It recording. Was like a parade of your favorite female performers all in one really smart, political, historical piece, which are just all my themes. So.
Yeah. They really are your
themes. Yeah, those are all my themes in one show.
I'm sensing a theme in our list
Yeah, so far I've said Soft Power and First Daughter Suite. Very political.
Yeah. And mine are all shows about Fagalas.
Well, stop. Okay, well, speaking of, number eight.
Casa Valentina.
There you go.
Harvey Fierstein's masterpiece.
Mm. I'm so bummed I missed it.
I've also seen several productions of this, including I went with Harvey Fierstein to the Pasadena Playhouse.
Oh, cool.
To see their production of it.
This was on Broadway, though, in 2014.
This was on Broadway. It was at Manhattan Theater Club at the Biltmore, mm-hmm. which it's not called the Biltmore anymore.
No, it's the Samuel J. Friedman Theater.
Sorry, Mr. Friedman. Yeah. At the Friedman. Stunning production. Really, again, with Patrick Page, who we love.
Yeah.
Really, really wonderful play.
And what's that story?
It's based on a real place in the late 50s or early 60s in the Catskills. There was a place called Casa Susana, mm-hmm. which was a place that men could go who were transvestites and spend the weekend. Mm. And they weren't all, you know, some of them were gay, but mostly they were straight men who just were transvestites and had no outlet to do this. And so there was a resort in the Catskills where they could dress up and be whoever they wanted to be. And this is a play about that experience.
Harvey Fierstein is just the best of us, right?
He really is.
And like he unearths these pieces of history. You know, we just saw it with Bella Bella this past fall, where he tells a story that like hasn't been told and needs to be urgently told right now.
And that is relevant, right? And that says something about our time and is also deeply personal to him.
Right.
Which is why I think his plays are so wonderful.
Yeah. Well, speaking of things that are deeply personal, my number eight play is Significant Other. Joshua Harmon's play that was at, I saw it off Broadway at the Roundabout in the Laura Pels, and then Intrepid Producers brought it to Broadway in 2017 at the Booth Theater, starring Gideon Glick as a young gay man sort of navigating that very real experience that I had of, you know, sort of having a circle of female friends who one by one are paired off with their husbands or partners, as you will. And discovering, you know, sort of having to reforge your own identity and friend circle in your late 20s as you're figuring out what it actually means to be a gay man. Because, you know, we don't really have the same experience that our straight counterparts have earlier in life, sort of figuring all that out. So this play, you know, it was not a hit. It was kind of, you know, dismissed. But to me, was an easy favorite because in a lot of eerie ways, it was like watching my life on stage, which can be devastating, but also really instructive and really beautiful and really powerful. I should mention, legendary actor Barbara Barry was in that play. And, you know, it's a treat to see her do anything, but she played the grandmother, who's sort of like the, you know, older sage in this character's life. Jordan Bellman, I think, is the character. I don't know. Maybe I dreamed that. Anyway, I loved that play. Did you see it?
I never knew. We've talked about this play a couple of times, and I never knew that you felt so personal. I never knew that the story was so personal to you.
Oh, totally.
I had no idea that you related with the experience that was happening.
And while we're talking about a decade's worth of things, the greatest Tony nomination snub of the decade was Gideon Glick not being nominated for a Tony for this show, because he was on stage the entire time and gave an incredible, nuanced, beautiful performance.
Yeah.
And he deserved not only a nomination, he deserved a Tony Award. I don't know who won it that year, but
I agree. Well, he did get a nomination a few years later.
He got my Tony Award. So we'll just
he did get a nomination a few years later. Was he not nominated for
To Kill a Mockingbird? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. All righty. So moving to musicals, number eight.
My number eight is Anyone Can Whistle, 2010 at Encores with the always incredible, always perfect Donna Murphy.
Oh my God.
In the role that was made famous by Angela Lansbury, Sutton Foster as Faye Apple, the role made famous, if you will, by Lee Remick. And then Raul Esparza, who was absolutely perfection as
in everything, but
in this, you know, I would imagine if you listen to this podcast, you are familiar with Anyone Can Whistle, which was a huge flop.
Seven performances,
as Lee Remick said,
or nine performances,
as Lee Remick said on the Tonys in 1987, the nine happiest nights of my life. but it was a big flop, mm-hmm. and
by Stephen Sondheim and Arthur Lawrence.
Correct. And directed by
Arthur Lawrence.
Oh, directed by Arthur Lawrence.
Yeah, I think he wrote the book and directed it.
Right, he did. But it's a fabulous score. It's a show that probably doesn't work. And what I love about encores is that they do these shows that don't get done. But somehow in the context of doing it stripped down at encores, it worked perfectly. Mm. And also, probably outside of Angela Lansbury, who originated, there's no one who could have played this part better than Donna Murphy. Oh, absolutely, yeah. No one. There's a little bit of YouTube video of it, shaky camera, can't see much, but you get a sense of what a flawless, flawless performance she gave.
One of my biggest regrets in life, or at least of the last decade, is that I didn't catch this. There's one Sondheim show that I haven't seen, and it's Anyone Can Whistle.
I thought, had you seen Do I Hear a Waltz?
Oh, I don't consider that a Sondheim show.
Really?
I'm of the ones he wrote the music and lyrics to.
Right. This is another one where I saw whatever the Thursday night performance. Right.
And then he went back
Friday, went back Saturday, and went back to their Sunday.
Well,
at
you
seven
have me what? At Donna Murphy.
Yeah.
Frankly, you have me at Donna. You don't even need the Murphy.
Yeah.
I'm there at Donna.
It was magic.
Well, number eight musical is another revival, Oklahoma, but it's not the Oklahoma you're thinking of.
Mm.
So in 2010, Arena Stage in Washington, D.C. did a revival of Oklahoma directed by Molly Smith, who was their artistic director, in their theater that's in the Round. And I didn't know Oklahoma. This was my first introduction to Oklahoma. Somehow it had just always passed me by. And it remains, I mean, clearly it's on my top 10 of the last decade. It's one of my favorite theatrical experiences ever. This was a joyous, gorgeous, beautiful production of Oklahoma that was traditional, yes, but also not traditional in a lot of ways. It had featured a multicultural cast, mm-hmm. Including an African-American Lori and a Hispanic Curly, really brought to life sort of the reality of the diversity of the Oklahoma Territory, which is a piece of history that is overlooked. When Molly Smith was, you know, researching for this production, she discovered that actually, yes, at the time there were African Americans in the Oklahoma Territory. There were Asian immigrants working on the railroad. You know,
right.
I mean, it was not this lily white, blonde haired community that, you know, you always see reflected in this show. So the multicultural casting of it was sort of a breakthrough at the time, and it was acclaimed. There were rumors it was going to come to Broadway.
Oh, you know, my husband and I came very close to it. We tried to get down to see it because everybody was talking about it.
It sold out, and then it came back in 2011. I saw it again in 2011. I mean, it was a real landmark. It also was the first show at the new Arena Stage facility. They had redone their theater. So it was a big moment for DC theater, which is a big moment for, you know, theater nationwide. So that production will always be really special to me. Oklahoma, 2010, Arena Stage. Number seven.
My number seven play is The Normal Heart.
Ugh.
And again, I have to qualify that there were sort of two productions of mm-hmm. that. There was it started as a reading, was I think a one-night reading that Joel Grey directed in 2010 at the Walter Kerr, which then led to, I think a year or two later, the full Broadway production, which was basically that same reading, but with lots of production elements and a slightly different cast.
I think George Wolfe got involved in that production.
And I was going to say, and by that point, George Wolfe had come in and co-directed it with Joel.
Was the cast the same?
Largely, at the Kerr, it was Glenn Close as the doctor, and on Broadway, it was Ellen Barkin, who won a Tony Award, I believe, for that.
I think that's right.
But Glenn Close, again, it's one of those was one of those magical performances that you only got to see. I think it was one night only. I think it was one night only.
Yeah.
And then they did it in LA, I think, after that. But that show, that moment in time for that show, both of those productions, just staggering.
Yeah. Well, it's going to show up on my list. So I'll say my piece now. You know, that it's, if you don't know the play, it's a play by Larry Kramer, who, in addition to being an incredible writer, was an activist and is an activist, particularly around HIV/AIDS activism in the 1980s. Sort of started, the movement for fighting for civil and human rights and
access.
He started ACT UP, right? You know, and sort of changed the face of that fight single-handedly, you know, with his leadership and getting others on board. And this play sort of dramatizes that period. The thing that's striking about this play, I saw it on Broadway in 2011, is that it was written in 1985. And Joel Grey was in the original production the Public Theater. He was a replacement because the actor who he replaced was dying of AIDS. And sitting in the theater in 2011 as someone, you know, who I was, you know, obviously a lot younger than I am now, but was in my early 20s and didn't really have a sense of what that moment was like, right? Of what the early days of the AIDS crisis were like. Seeing it dramatized and knowing that at the time it was written, it was not history, it was current events. And knowing as I left the theater in 2011 and seeing Larry Kramer there handing out pamphlets saying exactly that point, this isn't history, it's current events. Yeah. We are still living in a crisis. It looks differently than it did in 1981, but it's here. And, you know, talk about political theater, talk about a piece that is just, you know, rips your heart out. It was one of the few times in my life where I've had a hard time getting up out of my seat after the show. It finished and I had to be, an usher had to say like, okay, you've got to leave. That's how moved I was by that piece. Mm. Just incredible.
It's a powerful piece of theater.
Oh yeah.
No question. I was a member of ACT UP.
Wow.
Yeah. So it you know, it was a tough time.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, my number seven play is The Humans. Stephen Karam's play that won the Tony Award for Best Play in 2016. Did it win the Pulitzer? If not, it deserved it.
I don't think it did.
Yeah. Just extraordinary, not only for the play itself, which is brilliant, but that ensemble of actors, particularly
Reed Birney, Jane Howdyshell.
Oh, both of whom won Tony Awards, right? She won.
I don't know. I think he did too.
It was like everyone in that company was nominated. It was such a sensational play that captured, a strata of life of, you know, our society that you don't see dramatized often in such a real way, in such a powerful way. I was blown away by this play. I took my brother to see it, and he was just in tears. He was so moved by the power of the story.
It's a real slice of life.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
And those are hard to do.
Yes.
And those are hard to do well, and they're hard to make as impactful as he was able to do. And yeah. I think it's an important piece. I feel like it's on mine. It is on my list.
It was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. I just Googled that. And Joe Mantello directed, right? And like anytime Joe Mantello is directing something, you know it's going to be great.
Who was in... The Normal Heart.
That's right. Ooh, it's all coming together.
It's all connected.
Yes.
Okay. My number seven musical is a musical that's much talked about on this show, and that is Oklahoma.
Yes, in fact, we just talked about it.
We did indeed. But the Oklahoma that is the Daniel Fish Oklahoma, which is the version that...
Soon closing on Broadway.
Soon closing on Broadway that started at Bard and then moved to St. Anne's Warehouse and then eventually, thankfully, made it to Broadway. We've talked about it so much. Yeah. We have an episode with two of the stars, Ali Stroker and Mary Testa. I think I'll just leave it there.
Yeah. It's going to show up on my list too. Number seven on my list for musicals is The Scottsboro Boys. Kander and Ebb's, one of their last collaborations, if not their last collaboration. In fact, Fred Ebb had died before... it even premiered. I saw it on Broadway in 2011. It was at the Vineyard Theater before that. Susan Stroman directed. Again, really, I'm showing all my cards here. A piece of history.
Yep.
Musicalized in a way that at the time, you know, it was a hit at the Vineyard and was sort of a bit of a disappointment on Broadway. You know, it kind of didn't make the waves that I think everyone was expecting it would.
Didn't run very long. I didn't see it. In fact, I have you to thank for seeing it.
Yes.
Because you told me to see it when I was in D.C.
Yes.
Which not only did that bring that magnificent show into my life, but it also introduced me to the Signature Theater.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, so it had its first regional production in 2018 at Signature Theater in Arlington. Which just goes to show how like overlooked the show has been, right? That like it premiered in 2011 on Broadway and then had not had another regional production.
For seven years.
That's kind of crazy. And if you don't know this, you know, the story, it's a story about the Scottsboro Nine, African-American boys, really. I mean, truly boys, and you know, teenagers and younger who were falsely accused of raping two white women in Alabama in the early 20th century. And there was no evidence. I mean, they were just completely, falsely accused of this crime. And the show follows them through the legal process over the course of like nearly two decades. It's a tragic story. It's a story of America's racial past that, you know, again, we never confront these things. So to see it confronted in a musical. But what was amazing about the musical is that it took the form of a minstrel show. Mm-hmm. It had an all-black cast except for one white member, John Cullum, the incredible John Cullum. And I think that was part of the controversy around the show, frankly, is that it used the form of a minstrel show to tell the story. And, you know, minstrelsy obviously is very offensive. But that was part of the point.
I think it was the whole point, right?
People just completely missed what Kander and Ebb and Susan Stroman were doing with this piece. And it's one of those musicals that I feel like 10 years from now, 20 years from now, someone's going to do a revival, and it's going to be the biggest thing ever. And everyone's going to be like, oh my God, where was this musical? And I will show up on opening night and say, ha, 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 I was there in 2011, original fan of the show.
So Oz won't say nothing. It wouldn't help nothing when you can't help. The truth and nothing but.
Number six, play.
My number six is The Inheritance.
Which we talked about.
Which we talked about. I think we can leave it there.
Yes.
I think it's a magnificent, well, it's my number six.
There you go. It's your number six. My number six is A View from the Bridge, the 2015 production. There have been a couple revivals in this decade. It's an Arthur Miller play that gets done often because it's a fantastic play. But the 2015 production on Broadway had come from, I believe, The Young Vic.
So.
Or was it the old Vic? One of the Vics.
One of the Vics.
One of the Vics in London.
Eva van Hove.
Eva van Hove, the Belgian auteur of a director. This production, it was my introduction to the play. It's, I feel like it's kind of spoiled me forever because I'm always going to want to see this version. It was performed almost like in a boxing ring with the audience, you know, seated almost completely in the round and in plain clothes, very nondiscreet. And it was one of the most intense experiences I've ever spent in the theater, culminating, you know, now that I'm not spoiling anything, in a like literal shower of blood on stage. There was a slow drum beat in the background throughout the entire show. Like, the man's a master at creating tension and putting the audience on the, you know, sort of the edge of their seat. I absolutely loved it. It was brilliant. Number six, musical.
Soft Power.
Yeah, which we talked about.
Love it. Particularly, I will say,
yes,
Soft Power in San Francisco.
There was something about
the way it lived in the Curran Theater. There was something about the distance between the stage and the audience that just worked so beautifully. Whether I was sitting in the mezzanine, sitting in a great orchestra seat, or standing in the back, which I did. I was at the Curran Theater a lot during the run of that show.
Yeah.
And it was wonderful off Broadway. I don't mean to take anything away from it because it's a brilliant piece of theater, no matter what.
It stands on its own. But
for me in particular, I have to say it was that run at the Curran that was just magic.
Yeah. Well, you've touched on something that I think, a good portion of the show is a musical within the play that is supposed to be like the greatest musical that has ever been produced in China. So seeing it in a Broadway scale theater, it allows you to even be more immersed in what that
correct
concept is supposed to be, right? Which you couldn't really do at the public theater because it's the Newman Theater and it is what it is, right? It's not a Broadway house. My number six musical is A Strange Loop.
Yay!
Which was my number one show of 2019. Michael R. Jackson's just absolutely brilliant self-referential musical that is sort of like dramaturgically mind-blowing and brilliant and touches on, you know, questions of black and queer identity in a way that I had never seen in a musical before. Just absolutely loved it, and I know you do too. and it's going to show up again.
So, yes.
Moving on. Yeah.
There is a little bit of crossover with our list.
Well, that's, of course, number five.
Angels in America. Hands down, I think just, you know, one of the great plays and a great production.
So this was the 2018 production on Broadway, which has been...
Specifically on Broadway.
At the National Theater.
I saw it at the National Theater. It was wonderful. Yeah. There was a bit of a cast change. There was one of the cast members didn't come over. However, there was something about the entire company and Denise Goff in particular and James...
James McCardle.
The two of them in particular really grew into their roles from London to the States.
There's also something about seeing Angels in America in America, right? I mean, you know, there's a knowing sense of the history and the context that you just feel in an audience of Americans that you try as hard as you might not be able to experience in a British crowd.
And I think the intimacy of a Broadway theater versus the sort of cavernous Gielgud at the National also really helped just inform that whole production.
Yeah, totally, totally. Well, Marianne Elliott, the director, did a fabulous job, you know, sort of reimagining Angels in America for, you know, modern theatergoers. And I, this is one I really struggled with because I really wanted it to be in my top 10. It would be my 11. We were talking about 11s before.
There's a lot of 11s.
You know, because it was a really great, really, really great production. And a privilege to see Angels in America done on that scale, right? It had been at Signature Theater off Broadway earlier in the decade, which is why I pointed out which production you were referring to.
Right.
Because it was also an opera version at BAM.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know?
I cannot talk about this production of Angels in America without saying, thank you, Jordan Roth, for bringing this production over.
Yes.
Thank you, Jordan Roth, for believing in this production.
Totally.
And thank you, Jordan Roth, for allowing this production to be seen by everyone that was fortunate enough to see it.
Because
it's
a masterwork like Follies that everyone agrees is brilliant, but is never commercially successful. So you know going into it that it's not going to make money, but that's not why you do it.
And it's a risk that, thank God, he took.
Yeah.
Because he understands what it means to our society to be able to see this play.
And Tony Kushner.
Well,
Come on.
It all starts with Tony Kushner and the masterpiece that he wrote.
It's a masterpiece. And the prescience of his writing, too. The fact that it was written, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, finally making its way to Broadway in 1993. And it is still speaking to us. It is still revealing its own truths 2 decades later.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
My number five play is A Doll's House Part 2, Lucas Naith's continuation, I should say, of A Doll's House, which was on Broadway in 2017. We were just praising Jordan Roth for putting Angels in America on Broadway. I'm going to give a shout out to Scott Rudin, another producer, who had the foresight to take this play by an unknown playwright that had literally premiered on the West Coast like a couple weeks before it opened on Broadway. So this was a show that no one had seen. No one knew anything other than, about it or its playwright other than the title, which at the time, before I saw it, was like, that is like the worst title of a play ever. A Doll's House Part 2. Are you kidding me? I walked out of that show after, 90 minutes with my head spinning. I was like riding a high. I had to like walk home because I had so much energy I couldn't sit on a train, right? Like, Laurie Metcalf and Jane Howdyshell and Condoleezza Rashad and Chris
Cooper.
Chris Cooper, thank you. Chris Cooper. We're an outstanding ensemble in that play, directed by Sam Gold, that picks up 20 years after A Doll's House ends.
After she closes the door.
Yeah. And it starts with that door knock, right? And she comes back, Nora comes back, and it was absolutely brilliant.
There's no greater joy in life than Jane Howdy Shell saying, fuck you, Nora.
So
fuck
much so
you.
That I think they made tote bags.
I have a tote bag.
There you go.
That.
Yes. Let's say it. Yes, that's how amazing that moment was. Yeah. And I should say, Julie White replaced Laurie Metcalf.
She was fabulous.
And she was fabulous, too. I went back to see it. And it's you know, testament to the strength of the text that it really it withstood a cast change. So Doll's House Part 2, absolutely loved it.
My number 5 musical, we are back at the Public Theater. Yeah. And we are...
Did we ever leave the Public Theater?
No, no one should ever leave the Public Theater. But this would be the musical version of Love's Labor's Lost, which was the Michael Friedman musical that played at the Delacorte Theater in the summer of... I don't know, actually.
Yeah. Early, it was this decade, though. You do know that.
I do know it was this decade.
And I should say, you know, speaking of, we've talked about, you know, the AIDS crisis a couple times on the show. Michael Friedman, who passed away.
Right.
In 2018. From AIDS.
Yeah.
Right? Which is just a reminder of how real, you know, that crisis remains.
Right. And think of all of the wonderful work that we will not get from him.
Hey, boys, I'm through with you. Hey, boys, you don't have a clue.
My number 5 musical is The Band's Visit,
yes.
Which I got like the last ticket to when it was off Broadway at the Atlantic Theater Company in 2016, and then was jumping for joy when it opened on Broadway in 2017, and then won all the Tony Awards in 2018, and it's just a perfect musical. You know, there are very few musicals that are perfect, and I would submit that The Band's Visit's one of them.
You also called The Band's Visit a slow burn, which I thought was a really good way
to describe it. Well, you know, it's David Cromer directed it with, originally Hal Prince was attached to the project, and David Cromer came, you know, to be associated with it and directed it and guided it so beautifully to Broadway. It was, Ben Brantley called it in his review, he was like, thank God, a musical for adults.
Yeah.
Right?
That's
like,
what it is.
Finally, a musical for adults. There were a lot of shows that we loved over the past decade that took place in high schools, you know, or were jukebox musicals. Nothing wrong with a jukebox musical, but this was an original piece, you know, based off of a film, right? So, film adaptations, you know, A Little Night Music is a film adaptation. A lot of, you know, musical theater is an adaptive form, right? There are very few musicals that are purely original. But this was such a quiet, beautiful, slow burn of a musical that in the end, if you weren't crying, I don't know what to do or to say to you.
I was crying.
Yeah. No, I know. I wasn't saying that to you. I was saying you, yeah. Generally, you know, the public.
Right.
If that show didn't get you, then I don't know what would.
Then you are dead inside.
You're dead inside. There's no hope. And that was, I should say, David Yazbek wrote the music and lyrics. And one of his best scores, if not his finest score, which you might fight me on because I know you love Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
I love the score to Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. It's one of my absolute favorite scores of the last, you know, 2 decades.
Yeah.
So but I'm not going to fight you. That seems aggressive.
Okay.
So number four. My tie is between The Humans, which we discussed, and The Wolves.
Ah, oh, Sarah Dillaps, The Wolves.
Where
did you see it? Because it had several iterations, and each of them sold out.
Did I see it at Playwrights Horizon? I saw it on 42nd Street. So
that's right. I think it was at Playwrights. Yeah. I saw it at Lincoln Center.
And then I saw another production of it in San Francisco.
Oh, okay.
At the ACT has a small black box theater. Yeah. I think that's where it was. But it was stunning off-Broadway. Yeah. And one of those plays that you walked out of the theater going, what did I just see? Mm-hmm. What was that about? And then it just sort of sat with you. It didn't leave you it hasn't left me.
No.
The stunning piece of theater. Yeah. And I think it's done regionally all over. So it's
good. I mean, it deserves to enjoy a really long and fruitful life in any form. I was kind of bummed it didn't make the leap to Broadway because it felt like the kind of play that should. And that was, I think that was what, 2015, 2016?
Something like that.
I feel like we're now in a moment where that would happen, right? I mean, things have changed so much over the course of this decade, which is something that hopefully is being revealed by the picks that we have. My number four is Mr. Burns, a post-electric play, Anne Washburn play, that I saw at Woolly Mammoth Theater Company in D.C. Again, another
You love
DC,
a Woolly Mammoth.
I love a Woolly Mammoth. And again, made the same path as Booty Candy to New York and played at Playwrights Horizons, right? So it's sort of like the Playwrights Horizons of D.C.,
right.
Woolly Mammoth is. And this play, which David Henry Hwang actually cited as inspiration for Soft Power, is a show that deals with mythology. Did you see it?
No.
You didn't see it? Yeah, absolutely brilliant. I know it was on that list of the top 25 plays of the last 25 years, the New York Times did, because an episode of The Simpsons is used in a sort of post-apocalyptic U.S. as a way for these refugees to sort of find common, bond as they're sort of on the run. And then what you see over the course of the play after they have, shared their joy, their recounting of this episode of The Simpsons, is that it echoes forth into the future. And that story becomes mythologized and ends up being something totally different from what it started as. And you see the iterations of it along the way. Absolutely brilliant. It's, a comment on society. It's a comment on storytelling. It's a comment on theater. And dramaturgically, just so brilliant.
I'm sorry I missed it.
Yeah. Well, it's one that I have a feeling will have, has had a life and will continue to have a life.
Yeah, it was just at Yale Rep. Yeah, we had talked about trying to get up there and then, who has time
Who has the time? Musicals.
Okay, my number four is Fiddler on the Roof in Yiddish. Joel Grey's stunning, stunning production. I have to say, it's beautiful off-Broadway at Stage 42. However, when it played at the Museum of Jewish Heritage in Battery Park, walking out of that theater and past Ellis Island and the Statue of Liberty is so seared in my memory of being part of that production and a very key sort of button on the whole thing that it was stunning.
Yeah. That's, again, candidate for 11, right, on my list, right? I mean, easy 11. I adored that production. What Joel Grey did to unearth the humanity of those characters was unforgettable.
And it closes at the end of the week, so you still have time to jump and get a ticket.
If there are any available. My number four musical of the decade would be Caroline or Change, which obviously was created the decade prior, but received a top-notch revival over in the UK, starting at the Chichester Festival.
Chichester.
It's hard to say.
Chichester.
And moving to the West End in 2018, I caught a production there. It's coming to Broadway this spring. That production that I saw is coming to Broadway this spring. It's my number one favorite musical, probably.
And how many sets of tickets do you have already?
I'm going to keep that information private.
Okay,
good. I think it's best for all involved that not be publicly known.
Yes, I actually do know.
If you need to find me this spring, I'll be at 254 West 54th Street.
You will. And I have a feeling we're going to talk about it a fair amount.
Yes. And get used to hearing the name Sharon D. Clark.
Absolutely.
She stars in this this particular production. And again, Tony Kushner, Janine Tesori, names we've already mentioned on this episode. They wrote this musical in 2004, and I feel like it's another one that is finally, it's having what I predicted will happen with the Scottsboro Boys. Right. It's having this moment of, oh yeah, that was a brilliant show that was not appreciated in its time.
You need time.
Yeah, absolutely. Number three.
I can promise you my number three is not on anybody's list, but it's on mine. And that is David Henry Hwang's 2011 Chinglish.
I don't know this play.
I love Jinglish. It's a really, really smart and funny play.
What's it about?
And it's about the different, it's not dissimilar in themes to Soft Power. Mm. It's about the different culture, the different cultures between the West and, mm-hmm. and the East, particularly America and China.
Yeah.
And it's about an American businessman who's doing business with a Chinese corporation, and he meets a Chinese translator, and he learns a very funny and very hard lesson in foreign relations. Mm. And
Was this on Broadway?
It was off Broadway at the Public, I would imagine. I actually wasn't going to see it, and we got a ticket. I got a ticket for the final performance.
Yeah.
And boy, am I glad.
And now it's number three.
Yeah. I watched it recently, preparing for David Henry Hwang to come on our show last year. I went to Lincoln Center and watched it again, and was reminded at what a beautiful and funny. Sometimes it's okay to just laugh.
Yeah.
Show. And you know, I love his work.
Oh my gosh, he's a master formalist. He's an incredible playwright. And just such an important voice in the American theater, and has been for decades, and hopefully will continue to be for decades.
And this
to come.
Play is, I will say, it's on the lighter side, right? You know, it's very funny.
Like Yellowface, which I've read. I haven't seen Yellowface, but it's another play of his that is really funny, but also is making a really important point. Yeah. My number three play, which I can promise is on nobody's list, is The Damned, which was another Ivo van Hove production. This was at the Park Avenue Armory in 2018. If you've never been to the Park Avenue Armory, they curate really great seasons, and their space is just this giant drill hall. So they're able to produce works on a scale that you really can't see anywhere else. And this is a stage adaptation of a film from the 60s of the same title, The Damned. Visconti, I believe, is the director.
Yep.
This was done by the Comédie Française, right? The like 400, 500-year-old company from France. And it tells the story of a German industrialist family and their sort of decline paralleled with the rise of the Third Reich. It's horrifying. It was absolutely terrifying. It was one of the scariest things I've ever seen live and in person. The imagery of that show, I can summon it all in my mind. It haunts me. It was violent and sexual and graphic and deeply upsetting, deeply memorable, and I don't know what it says about me, but one of my favorite shows, number three of the last decade.
Deeply disturbing and upsetting.
Yeah,
I love
violent
it.
And sexual. Please also include that. Number three, musical.
A Strange Loop.
We've already talked about.
We have, and I think we can leave it there and just say that I hope it gets another production and get the album.
Get the album. Listen to it right now. Not right now. Finish this episode, then listen to it. And to ping pong here, my number three is Oklahoma, which we already talked about. Daniel Fish's Oklahoma. Second time Oklahoma appears on my list, but a different production, the brilliant one that is closing soon on Broadway. Okay, number two plays.
Ooh, we're getting to the end. My number two is Three Tall Women, the production of 2018 that starred Laurie Metcalf and Alison Pill and...
Drum roll.
Glenda Jackson. Mm. In one of the finest productions of a play I've ever seen.
Directed by Joe Mantello.
Directed by Joe Mantello.
And produced by Scott Rudin. Right. There's a lot of familiar names on this on this podcast. Yeah. No, it was magnificent. It was an Edward Albee play that had won the Pulitzer Prize and had a very healthy run off Broadway in the 1990s, but was sort of forgotten almost. Yeah. And Scott Rudin had the foresight, again, to put it on stage with these incredible actors. One of my, it wasn't on my top 10, but again, it's an 11. One of my favorite performances ever.
We have a lot of 11s. A
lot of 11s. 11s are a really thick band of plays. My number two, as no surprise to anyone who knows me, is What the Constitution Means to Me.
I have to say I'm surprised. I'm shocked when I read this list that it was number two.
And not number one.
Shocked.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I couldn't.
Yeah.
I actually had to look at the paper twice to make sure that I was reading it correctly.
Yeah. Wow.
You really threw me for a loop with this one.
Well, Heidi Schreck's play, What the Constitution Means to Me, I will always consider to be one of the best things that I've ever seen. I saw it off Broadway at New York Theater Workshop, where it arrived after being developed at Club Thumb. And on amazingly, again, thanks to some intrepid visionary producers, moved to Broadway and was a sensation there.
And did beautifully. Did great business.
I mean, it was like the little show that could.
Yeah, it's a testament to believe in your art.
Yes, and you know, this is a play about one woman's relationship with the Constitution, and through the lens of the women in her family, and in the context of the society that we live in, there's nothing that was more timely in 2019, 2018, particularly as we were seeing Kavanaugh put on the Supreme Court and Trump and all the just horror that we're living through. This play was a beacon of hope, a beacon of truth, and a really powerful, courageous act of citizenship for Heidi Schreck to write this piece. And it's touring the country right now, if you can see it, not with Heidi, but with other actors, which is also really exciting. I would love to see someone else step into the shoes.
Something tells me that you will.
Yeah, if I can make it happen, I will. But yes, I think it's one of the most important plays of the decade. Certainly one of my favorite at number two. Musicals.
Well, my number two, we are back at the Public Theater.
Yeah, did we leave?
I never leave the Public Theater.
In your mind, the Public Theater in your mind.
Which I think they're slightly aware of too. Here Lies Love. David Byrne's opus to the Imelda Marcos. Well, to really the Marcoses. It's really both their story, although it tends to really tell it through her lens.
This is a show that you look at the original cast list and you're like, oh my God. Talk about a stacked cast, right?
Well, it's Ruthie Ann Miles playing Imelda Marcos.
Yeah.
Ferdinand Marcos is played by Jose Lana, who's been on our show. We are huge fans of.
Yes.
Conrad Riccamora, who was in Soft Power, plays Aquino. And an incredible ensemble of Billy Bustamante.
Yes.
And, I mean, it just the
goes on.
It goes on and on.
And that was an immersive production by Alex Timbers, the director, where you sort of moved around the space. George Salazar was in it. There you go. I mean, see, if we had it in front of us, we could name drop, you know, another 10 people, I'm sure. Yeah, really incredible. I saw it when it came back to the public, right? Because it was such a hit that it came back. And it was certainly one of the more unique experiences I've ever had. It was one of the first sort of like immersive shows, right? To be in New York, to really, where you move.
Yeah, it was sort of meant to be a dance party, too.
Yeah. There have been a lot of environmental shows. I mean, you think of like How Princess Candide, right? Environmental theater has always existed, but they sort of was ahead of the curve on this newer wave, you know, Sleep No More and all these other types of immersive experiences. Here Lies Love was certainly a landmark show for that movement.
And it's recorded and it's well worth a listen
to. Yeah, I know I should listen to it. I haven't listened to it since I saw it.
Oh, I listen to it all the time.
Yeah. My number two musical, which I think Jamie peaked and expressed his surprise at, is Hello, Dolly.
Yeah, your number twos are very controversial.
Between what the Constitution means to me and Hello, Dolly, you would have expected them to be my number ones.
Absolutely.
Specifically, this is the glorious, heaven-sent 2017 Broadway revival starring Bette Midler and David Hyde Pierce and Jennifer Simard. And Gavin Creel and Kate Baldwin and Beanie Feldstein and Taylor Trench. I could go on. This production, this is going to sound so dramatic, but we're dramatic here on this show. It's a theater podcast. This show got me through 2017. In the wake of the 2016 election and just the gut punch of living through the horror of the destruction of our democracy before our very eyes, being able to go to the Schubert Theater and see this Valentine of a musical, you know, there are a few perfect musicals. I called The Band's Visit one. Hello, Dolly is another perfect musical. The book by Michael Stewart, based on Thornton Wilder's play, is absolutely incredible. Jerry Herman's score. If I needed a pick-me-up, I bought a ticket. I saw this production 9 times. It is the show.
I have you beat at 11 or 12.
Yeah, this is the show on Broadway that I have seen the most in my life because I kept returning to it, not only because Bette Midler was amazing, but on Tuesday nights, Donna Murphy slipped into the role. And I already said earlier on this podcast, all you need to do is say Donna, and I'm there. And we had her on as our second guest. She was an extraordinary Dolly. And we had another Dolly on the show with Betty Buckley, who did the national tour. And Carolee Carmello is doing it right now, who is like, you know, someone I just absolutely adore. So Hello Dolly just has always had a very special meaning
and
to
you,
me.
And you left one out.
Oh, who did I leave? Oh, Bernadette Peters. Oh my gosh. Wow. I would say this can't be public, but it's a podcast, so everyone's now going to know that I left out Bernadette Peters. Wow. Well, I'm, you know, whipping myself right now. Mea culpa, mea culpa.
She'll forgive you.
Yeah.
Jennifer Simard may not forgive
well,
you.
Well, no, I know. People say that in this production, Bernadette Peters invented stairs.
Yeah, that's true.
Right? And she can take credit for inventing stairs. Because when she entered the Harmonia Gardens, it was unlike anything.
Yeah, yeah, all those ladies, they were all, I mean, you know, Bette was the event. And it was really, really, you know, it was really special. But
yes,
every lady that's played it has brought something different to it and something unique and
absolutely
has really shown what they are, what they mean to Broadway and to performing and why they are who they are. And every single one of them was special. Mm. And that's not, I mean that sincerely.
Of course. And my only regret is that it didn't run forever so we could see every female actress who we love step into that dress, you know, and maybe even a couple men.
Right. Well,
I'd love to see Billy Porter's Dolly Levi.
Oh, that would be wonderful.
You know, well, I'm just putting that into the universe.
Who knows? Who knows?
But yeah, that production was really, really, really special. Jerry Zaks, Warren Carlyle, guest of the show. Just a perfect combination of elements.
And you're right. It is it's the Valentine that America needed to get through a very difficult time.
Yep.
There's no question about that.
And still
that
needs.
Golly gee.
Okay.
Number one.
We're here.
My number one play of the decade is Clybourne Park.
Wow.
I don't know what else to say about it.
Okay.
It's for those of you that don't know, it's it basically is, how do you say it? A before and after of Raisin in the Sun, a continuation of Raisin in the Sun, a
sort of like almost in a way the negation of it, right? I mean, it's a... Act one is a white family living in a home, and then act two is a black family living in the same home decades later, right?
Right. Did you not see Clybourne Park?
I saw it at Willie Mammoth Theater Company in D.C., and I remember it not really doing anything for me, which is why I was kind of shocked that it was number one on your list. Wow. But that's why we do these lists. That's why it's fun, right?
Lists.
Everybody, you know, theater means different things to different people. And maybe if I saw it today, I would say it's the best play I've ever seen. I don't know. That's the other thing, right, is who you are at the time informs how things land, right?
Yep.
And I think I have grown, I've grown in my appreciation and acknowledgement of race in America from 2012 to the present. You know, I think that there were certain blinders that I had on given my, you know, the privilege of my upbringing and education that my world has been burst open in the last 6 years, I'd say, at least. So I'd be interested to see this play again. It won all the awards. It was a huge,
big
huge
hit.
Yeah.
Written by Bruce Norris.
Right, yeah. And it won the Olivier, it won the Tony, it won the Pulitzer Prize. It's an important play.
Absolutely.
Great, okay. So my number one play of the decade, we already talked about, and that is The Normal Heart.
Yep.
So I don't think we need to say anything more than...
Well, we've talked about all of these because my musical is Hello, Dolly.
Huh, about that. And my musical is Follies. So at the National Theater. So...
There's our decade.
There's our decade. Wow. Well, I think it's quite interesting that when looking back over the past decade, a lot of the productions that pop up throughout are revivals of plays and musicals from the 20th century, which I don't think is a bad thing. In fact, I think it's quite exciting to see artists in the 21st century reinterpreting works from the 20th century in exciting ways, in some ways that are really bold in terms of a departure, like Oklahoma, or in some ways that are like a love letter to the form with like Hello, Dolly. Or, you know, you could take the same convention with The Normal Heart and A View from the Bridge, right? That same device of one approach that's, you know, very different and one approach that's, you know, sort of an homage to. So that's one trend that I sort of picked up when I sat back and looked at our two lists. I don't know if anything struck you. Also, the public theater is all over this, and Scott Rudin.
Yeah, I was struck by those two things. I was struck by the
and Playwrights Horizons. You know,
yeah, a lot of playwrights' horizons. I was struck by the fact that my list skewed very heavily towards gay representation in the theater.
Yeah,
your list skewed a little bit more towards politics and Oklahoma, which is also political.
Yes,
you
of
know,
course.
If you, it, yeah. Particularly the arena stage version that you spoke about earlier. Yeah. I mean, that really took a political look at the sort of the landscape or a racial
politics of it all. Yeah, yeah,
exactly. And I think that those themes are obviously important to us.
Yeah,
it's what we were drawn to in this last decade.
Well,
and if you look at the decade, it makes sense.
Yeah. Totally. What a decade.
Yeah.
What a decade. I will also notice that a lot of revivals in our musicals, too.
Yeah.
Right? When we're talking about our favorites of the last decade, a lot of revivals. The newer work, you know, there were a lot of things that we enjoyed, but I think that in taking a step back and looking at the decade, there weren't as many new musicals that really grabbed us.
I didn't have one new musical on my list that was on Broadway. The only two new musicals on my list were both off-Broadway.
Mm, how about that? Yeah. I had two. Yeah, I had two.
But my number 11 would have been Hadestown.
Oh,
so,
same.
So
the 11s are fertile field.
Well, and that was a very, 11 is a whole, 11 is another.
We should do an episode that's just the 11s.
Correct.
You know?
But Hadestown was a tough choice.
Yeah.
I really wanted to make that fit on there.
Amazing. Well, as we look ahead to the next decade, the roaring 20s, just saying that out loud is crazy. There's much to look forward to, even that just this spring season.
That there is.
Cool. Well, here's to a great year ahead.
Yes.
There's a place where we belong. There's a place where we belong. And you'll hear us sing our song in this place where we belong.
That's our show. Thanks for listening. You can hear us anytime on iTunes. The Fabulous Invalid is a production of O&M Etc. and The Fabulous Invalid LLC, and a proud member of the Broadway Podcast Network. Our theme music is by Lucky Chops. Today's episode was edited and engineered by Aaron Kaufman and Charles Van Kirk. Find us online at thefabulousinvalid.com and on social media at @fabulousinvalid and on iTunes, Spotify, and wherever you find your podcasts. And be sure to tune in next Wednesday.
In this place where we belong, in this place where we belong.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.